Dahlias muttered. He lifted a hand to shield his eyes from the wind, and leaned over the edge of the litter. A brilliant moon, looming large among a sea of stars, painted the landscape below in silver and black. Wooded hills rolled slowly beneath them, a solid darkness, broken here and there by silver-kissed clearings and winding half-luminescent rivers. Four of the knight's heiress from the camp bore them through the air, one at each pole of the litter. They wore harnesses that fitted them to the litter, supporting the weight of the three people inside, while the knight's weight, in turn, was borne by the powerful furies at their command. Another half-dozen knight's heiress flew in a loose ring around the litter, and moonlight glittered on the steel of their arms and armor.
"Captain," Fidelius called to the lead knight.
The man glanced back over his shoulder, murmured something, and drifted back through the air toward the litter.
"Sir?" "Will it be much longer before we arrive in Aquitaine?"
"No, sir, we should be there before the hour is out."
Fidelius blinked.
"That soon? I thought you said it would take us until dawn."
The knight shook his head, eyes coolly scanning the sky ahead.
"Fortune favors us, sir. The furies of the south are stirring and have brought us a strong wind to speed our way."
The former curser frowned.
"That's highly unusual at this season, is it not, Captain?"
The man shrugged.
"It saved us hours of flight time and made it easier on everyone. We haven't even had to spell the men bearing the litter. Relax, sir. I'll have you in the High Lord's palace before the witching hour."
And with that, the soldier accelerated, moving to take position ahead of the litter again. Fidelius frowned and resettled on his seat. He glanced over the side of the litter again, and his stomach jumped and fluttered with an irrational sensation of fear. He knew that he was as safe flying in the litter escorted by knight's heiress as anywhere in the realm, but some part of his mind simply would not casually accept the vast distance between himself and the ground below. Here he was far from wood and earth, far from the furies he could call to his service, and that disturbed him. He had to rely upon the strength of the knights with him rather than his own. And everyone other than himself had in time inevitably disappointed him. He folded his arms and bowed his head against the wind, brooding. Gaius had used him from the very beginning. Used him with a purpose, to be sure, and never carelessly. He had been far too valuable a tool to waste through misuse or neglect. Indeed, at times the precarious peace of the entire realm had occasionally hinged upon his ability to accomplish on behalf of the crown. Fidelius felt his frown deepen. Gaius was old, the old wolf that led the pack, and it was nothing more than a matter of time before he was hauled down to his death. But despite that brutal, simple truth, Gaius continued to fight against the inevitable. He could have turned over power to a nominal heir a decade ago, but instead he had held on, wily and desperate, and delayed matters for a decade by pitting the High Lords against one another in bids to see who could position his daughter or niece to marry the First Lord and give birth to the new princeps. Gaius, with Fidelius's aid, of course, had played the lords off of one another with merciless precision, until every High Lord of Alera spent years convinced that his candidate would surely be the one to wed Gaius. His eventual choice had pleased no one, not even High Lord Parsius, Caria's father, and even the most dense of the High Lords had realized in time that they had been played for fools. The game had been well played, but in the end it had all been for nothing. The House of Gaius had never been a fertile one, and even if he had proved physically capable of producing an heir, which Fidelius remained unsure about, the First Lady had not as yet shown herself to be with child, and palace rumour held that the First Lord seldom went to the same bed in which his wife slept. Gaius was old. He was dying. The star of his house was falling from the heavens, and anyone who blindly clung to the hem of his robes would fall with him. Like Amara. Fidelius frowned, while something nagged at him, distracted him, burned in his belly. It was a pity, to be sure, that Amara had chosen a fool's crusade rather than making an intelligent decision. Surely if he'd had more time, It may have proved possible to encourage her to see a more rational point of view. Now, instead, he would have to act directly against her if she interfered again. And he did not want to do that. Fidelius shook his head. The girl had been his most promising student, and he had let her come to mean too much to him. He had destroyed some 60 men and women in his years as a cursor, some of them as powerful and idealistic as Amara. He had never hesitated to perform his duty, never let himself be distracted by anything so trivial as personal attachment. His love was for Alera. And that was really the issue at hand. Fidelius served the realm, not the First Lord. Gaius was doomed. Delay of the transfer of power from Gaius's hands to another could only cause strife and bloodshed among the high lords who would wish to assume Gaius's station. It might even come to a war of succession, something unheard of since the dawn of Aleran civilization, but which was rumored to have been commonplace in the distant past. And should that happen, not only would the sons and daughters of Alera die pointlessly fighting one another, but the division itself would be a signal fire to the enemies of the realm, the savage Icemen, the bestial Marat, the ruthless Karnim, and who knew what else in the unexplored wilds of the world. Above all else, such weakening of the realm's unity had to be circumvented. And that meant establishing a strong ruler, and swiftly. Already the High Lords quietly defied the First Lord's authority. It would only be a matter of time before the High Lords and their cities disbanded the realm into a cluster of city nations. And if that happened, it would be simple for the enemies of mankind to quietly nibble away at those realms until nothing was left. Fidelius grimaced, his belly burning more sharply. It had to be done, like a battlefield surgeon forced to remove a mangled limb. There was nothing that would make it less gruesome. The best one could hope for was to get it done as swiftly and cleanly as possible. Which led to Aquitanus. He was the most ruthless, the most able, and perhaps the strongest of the High Lords. Fidelius's stomach roiled. He had betrayed Gaius, the Codex, the Cursors, betrayed his student Amara. He had turned his back on them, to support a man who might become the most ruthless and bloodthirsty dictator Alera had ever known. The Furies knew he had tried everything in his power to convince Gaius to take another path. Fidelius had been forced to this. It was necessary. It had to be done. His stomach burned as the glowing fury lights of Aquitaine appeared on the horizon. "Wake up," he murmured. "We're almost there." Aldric opened his eyes and focused on Fidelius. One hand absently caressed Odiana's dark wealth of hair, and she let out a pleased little whimper in her sleep, writhing in the man's lap with liquid sensuality before settling into stillness again. The swordsman watched Fidelius, his expression unreadable.
"Deep thoughts, old man?" Aldric asked. "Some. How will Aquitaine react?"
The big man pursed his lips.
"It depends."
"On what?"
"On what he is doing when we interrupt him with bad news."
"Is it all that bad?"
Aldric smiled.
"Just hope he's up drinking. He's usually in a pretty good mood. Tends to forget his anger by the time the hangover has worn off."
"It was an idiot's plan to begin with."
"Of course, it was his. He isn't a planner of deception or subterfuge. But I've never met a man who could lead as strongly as he does. Or anyone with his raw power."
Aldric continued stroking the sleeping Water Witch's hair, his expression thoughtful.
"Are you worried?"
"No," Fidelius lied. "I'm still too valuable to him."
"Perhaps, for now," Aldric said.
He smiled,
a mirthless expression. "But I'll not be loaning you any money."
Fidelius clucked his teeth.
"Direct action would have been premature in any case. By escaping, the girl may have done his grace the biggest favor of his life."
I don't doubt it, Aldrich murmured. But somehow I'm almost certain that he won't see it that way.
Fidelia studied the other man's face, but the swordsman's features revealed nothing. His grey eyes blinked lazily, and his mouth curled into a smile, as though taking amusement in Fidelius's lack of ability to gauge him. The cursor frowned at the man, a mild expression, and turned to watch the city of Aquitaine come into sight. First came the lights. Firecrafters by the dozens maintained the lights along the city's streets, and they burned with a gentle radiance through the mist-shrouded evening, all soft yellows, deep amber, pale crimson, until the hill upon which the city was built seemed itself to be one enormous living flame, garbed in warmth and flickering colour. Upon the city's walls, and just beyond them, lights burned with a cold blue brilliance, casting the ground far around into stark illumination and long black shadows, their harsh glare vigilant against any would-be invaders. As the litter glided down, and closer, Fidelius could begin to make out shapes in the shifting lights. Statues stood silent and lovely on the streets. Houses, all elegant lines and high arches, contested with one another to prove the most skillfully crafted, the most beautifully lit. Fountains sparkled and flickered, some of them illuminated from below, so that they burned violet or emerald in the darkness, pools of liquid flames. Trees rose up around houses and lined the streets, thriving and beautiful life that had been crafted as carefully as every other part of the city. They too wore veils of coloured light, and their leaves, already changed into autumn's brilliant hues, shone in too many shades to count. The sound of a bell tolling the late hour rose to the descending litter. Fidelius heard the trod of hooves upon paving stones somewhere below, and raucous singing from a nightclub of some kind. Music came up from a garden party as the litter passed over it, strings supporting a sweet alto flute that pursued a gentle, haunting melody. The smell of wood smoke and spices still drifted on the evening breezes, along with the scent of late-blooming flowers and of rain on the wind. To call Aquitaine beautiful was to call the ocean wet, Fidelius thought. Accurate enough in its way, but wholly insufficient to the task. They were challenged by a barking voice before they had come within a long bowshot of the High Lord's manor, a walled fortress surmounting the hill upon which the city stood. Fidelius watched as a man in the sable and scarlet surcoat of Aquitaine swept down from the air above. A dozen more hovered somewhere in the night sky above them, unseen, but the cursor could feel the eddies of wind that their furies kicked up in keeping them aloft. The challenger of the knight's heiress guarding the High Lord's manor exchanged a passphrase with the captain of Fidelius's own escort, though the exchange had the comfortable routine air of a formality. Then the group swept on forward, down into the manor's courtyard, while more guards watched from the walls, along with leering statues, wrought in the shapes of hunchbacked, gangly men. The moment Fidelius stepped from the litter, he felt the light, steady tremors of power in the earth that led back to each statue on the wall, and found himself staring at the statues.
"Gargoyles?" he breathed. "All of them?"
Aldrich glanced at the statues and then to Fidelius and nodded once.
"How long have they been kept here?"
"As long as anyone remembers," Aldrich rumbled.
"Aquitaine is that strong."
Fidelius pursed his lips in thought. He did not agree with the principles of anyone who kept furies within such a restrictive confine, much less those who would trap them there for generations. But it certainly confirmed, had he been in any doubt, that Aquitaine's raw power was more than sufficient for the task at hand. The knight's heiress accompanying the litter departed toward a bunkhouse for food and drink, while the captain of Aquitaine's guard, a young man with an earnest expression and alert blue eyes, opened the door to the litter and extended a courteous hand to those within. Then he led them inside the manor proper. Fidelius took casual note of the manor as he followed the young captain, marking the doors, the windows, the presence or evident lack of guards. It was an old habit, and one he would be foolish to surrender. He wanted to know the best way to leave any place he walked into. Aldrich walked beside him, casually carrying the still-sleeping Odiana as though she weighed no more than an armload of cloth, each footstep something solid, focused. The young captain swung open a pair of double doors leading into a long feasting hall, complete with mountain-style fire pits built into the floors, already burning though the season had not yet grown truly cold. That dim crimson light was the only illumination in the hall, and Fidelius took a moment to pause inside the doors and allow his eyes to adjust. The hall stretched out, lined with a double row of smooth marble pillars. Curtains covered the walls, providing a bit of aesthetic warmth and the perfect cover for eavesdroppers, guards, or assassins. The tables had been taken down for the night, and the only furniture in the hall was a table and several chairs upon a dais at the far end. The shapes of people moved about there, and Fidelius could hear the gentle music of strings. The captain led them all straight down the hall and toward the dais. Upon a large chair covered in the fur of a grass lion from the Amaranth Vale sprawled a man, as tall as Aldrich, Fidelius judged, but more slender, and with the appearance of a young man in the prime of his youth. Aquitanus had high cheekbones and a narrow face, led by a strong jaw whose lines were softened by the tumble of dark golden hair that fell to his shoulders. He wore a simple scarlet blouse with black leather breeches and soft black boots. A goblet dangled lazily in one hand, while the other held the end of a long strip of silken cloth that slowly unwound from the shapely girl dancing before him, gradually baring more and more of her skin. Aquitanus had eyes of pitch black, stark in that narrow face, and he watched the dancing slave with an almost feverish intensity. Fidelius's eyes were drawn to the man standing behind and just a bit to one side of the High Lord's chair. In the dimness, details were difficult to make out. The man wasn't tall, perhaps only a few inches more than Fidelius himself, but was strongly built, his posture casually powerful, relaxed. He bore a sword at his hip, that much Fidelius could see, and a very slight bulge in his dark grey tunic perhaps revealed the presence of a hidden weapon. Fidelius met the silent man's eyes briefly and found the stranger's gaze to be opaque, assessing.
"If you value your head, Captain," Aquitanus murmured without looking away from the girl, "it can wait until this dance is done."
His voice, Fidelius noted, carried the faintest trace of a drunken slur.
"No, Your Grace," Fidelius said, stepping forward and past the captain. "It can't."
The High Lord's back stiffened, and he turned his head slowly toward Fidelius. The weight of the man's dark eyes fell onto the cursor like a physical blow, and he drew in a sharp breath as he felt the stirring in the earth beneath them. A slow and sullen vibration deep within the stone, a reflection of the High Lord's anger. Fidelius assumed a casually confident stance and reacted as though Aquitanus had acknowledged him. He clasped a fist over his heart and bowed. There was a long silence before Fidelius heard Aquitanus's reaction. The man let out a low and relaxed laugh that echoed throughout the nearly deserted hall. Fidelius straightened again to face the High Lord, careful to keep his expression schooled into neutral respect.
"So," Aquitanus purred, "this is the infamous Fidelius Cursor Calidus. If it please your grace, Cursor no longer. You seem rather unconcerned with my pleasure," Aquitanus noted, with the droll roll of the hand still clasping the dancing girl's cloth. "I almost find it disrespectful."
"No disrespect was intended, Your Grace. There are grave matters that require your attention."
"Require my attention?"
murmured Aquitaine with an elegant arch of brow.
My! I don't think I've been spoken to in that fashion since just before my last tutor took that untimely fall.
Your Grace will find me a good deal more agile.
Rats are agile, sniffed Aquitaine. The oaf's real problem was that he thought he knew everything.
Ah, Fidelius said. You will not face that difficulty with me.
Aquitaine's dark eyes shone.
Because you really do know everything? No, Your Grace, only everything of importance.
The High Lord narrowed his eyes. He remained silent for 20 of Fidelius's quickening heartbeats, but the cursor refused to let his nervousness show. He took slow and even breaths and remained silent, waiting. Aquitaine snorted and drank off his remaining wine with an effortless flick of his wrist. He held the goblet out to one side, waited a beat, then released it. The blocky man beside him reached out a hand, snake-swift, and caught it. The stranger walked to the table on the dais and refilled the goblet from a glass bottle.
"My sources told me that you had a reputation for insouciance, Fidelius," Aquitaine murmured. "But I had no idea that it would be so readily forthcoming."
"If it please your grace, perhaps we might table this discussion for the moment. Time may be of the essence."
The High Lord accepted the goblet of wine from the stranger, glancing at the pretty slave, now kneeling on the floor before him, head bowed. Aquitaine let out a wistful sigh.
"I suppose," he said. "Very well, then. Report."
Fidelius glanced at the stranger, then at the slave, and then at the hanging curtains.
"Perhaps a more private setting would be more appropriate, Your Grace."
Aquitaine shook his head.
"You can speak freely here. Fidelius, may I present Count Calyx of the Feverthorn Border in service to His Grace High Lord of Rhodes. He has shown himself to be a shrewd and capable adviser and a loyal supporter of our cause."
Fidelius shifted his attention to the blocky man beside the High Lord's seat.
"The Feverthorn Border. Isn't that where that illegal slaving operation got broken up a few years ago?"
Count Calyx spared the former cursor a thin-lipped smile. When he spoke, his voice came out in a light, rich tenor completely at odds with the heavy power evident in his body.
"I believe so, yes. I understand that both the Slavers' Consortium and the Dianic League gave you commendations for valor above and beyond the call of duty."
Fidelius shrugged, watching the other man.
"A token gesture. I was never able to turn up enough information to bring charges against the slave ring's leader."
He paused for a moment, then added,
"Whoever he was."
"A pity," said the Count. "I imagine you cost someone a great deal of money."
"Most likely," Fidelius agreed.
"It could give a man good reason to hold a grudge."
Fidelius smiled.
"I'm told those can be inimical to one's good health."
"Perhaps I'll put it to the test one day."
"Should you survive the experience, be sure to let me know what you learned."
Aquitaine watched the exchange, his dark eyes sparkling with mirth.
"I hate to interrupt your fencing, gentlemen, but I have other interests this evening and we have issues to discuss."
He took another sip of wine and waved at the other chairs on the dais.
"Sit down. You too, Aldric. Should I have someone carry Odiana to her chambers so that she can rest?" "Thank you, sir," Aldric rumbled. "I'll keep her with me and take care of her later if it's all the same to you."
They settled down into chairs facing Aquitaine. The High Lord gestured and the slave girl hurried to one side, returning with the traditional cloth and bowl of scented water. Then the girl settled at Fidelius's feet and unlaced his sandals. She removed the stockings beneath, and with warm, gentle fingers began washing Fidelius's feet. He frowned down at the slave, pensively, but at a second gesture from the High Lord, Fidelius uttered a concise report of the events at the camp of the Renegade Legion. Aquitaine's expression darkened steadily throughout, until at the end it had grown to a scowl.
"Let me test my understanding of what you are telling me, Fidelius," Aquitaine murmured. "Not only were you unable to attain intelligence regarding Gaius's chambers from this girl, in addition she escaped from you and every one of my knights."
Fidelius nodded.
"My status has been compromised, and she is almost certainly reported to the crown by now. The Second Legion has already been disbanded into individual centuries," Aldric supplied.
The slave moved to kneel at his feet and to remove his sandals and stockings as well. The single long piece of scarlet cloth wound around her had begun to slip and gape, displaying an unseemly amount of supple, smooth skin. Aldric regarded her with casual admiration as he continued.
"They will meet at the rendezvous as planned." "Except for the Windwolves," Fidelius said. "I advised Aldric to send them ahead to the staging area."
"What?" snarled Aquitaine, rising.
"That was not according to the plan."
The blocky Calyx came to his feet as well, his eyes bright.
"I warned you, Your Grace. If the mercenaries are not seen in Parcia over the winter, there will be nothing to link them to anyone but you. You have been betrayed."
Aquitaine's furious gaze settled on Fidelius.
"Well, Cursor, is what he says true?"
"If you consider adjusting to changing conditions in the field treachery, Your Grace," Fidelius said, "then you may name me traitor, if it pleases you."
"He twists your own words against you, Your Grace," Calyx hissed. "He is using you. He is a Cursor, loyal to Gaius. If you keep listening to him, he will lead you to your death at Gaius's feet. Kill him before he poisons your thoughts any further. He, this murderous thug and his mad whore, they all want nothing but your destruction."
Fidelius felt his lips tighten into a smile. He looked from Aquitaine to Calyx, then to Aldric, where the slave crouched at his feet, her lips parted, her eyes staring. Over Aldric's lap, Odiana neither stirred nor spoke, but he could see her mouth turn up into a smile.
"Ah,"
Fidelius said, his own smile spreading wider. He folded one ankle over the other knee.
"I see."
Aquitaine narrowed his eyes and stalked over to stand over Fidelius's chair.
"You have interrupted a pleasant moment with the anniversary gift given me by my own dear wife. You have, it would seem, failed miserably in what you said you would do for me. Additionally, you have dispatched my troops in a fashion which could embarrass me acutely before the rest of the Lord's Council, not to mention the Senate."
He leaned down toward Fidelius and said, very gently,
"I think it would be in your own best interest to give me a reason not to kill you in the next few seconds."
"Very well," Fidelius said.
"If you will indulge me briefly, Your Grace, I may be able to let you decide for yourself whom you can trust."
"No," sputtered Calyx. "My lord, do not allow this deceitful slave to so use you."
Aquitaine smiled, but it was a cold, hard expression. His gaze swept the Rhodesian count, and Calyx dropped silent at his glance.
"My patience is wearing very thin. At the rate we're going, gentlemen, someone will be dead by the end of this conversation."
Heavy tension fell onto the room, thick as a winter blanket. Calyx licked his lips, throwing a wide-eyed glare at Fidelius. Odiana made a soft sound and stirred artlessly on Aldric's lap before settling again, leaving Aldric's right arm free to reach for his sword, Fidelius noted. The slave seemed to take notice of the tension as well and crawled a bit backward until she was no longer between the High Lord and anyone else in the room. Fidelius smiled. He folded his hands and rested them on his knee.
"If it please Your Grace, I will need paper and pen."
"Paper and pen? What for?
Easier to show you, Your Grace. But if you remain unsatisfied after, I offer you my life as penance."
Aquitaine's teeth flashed.
"My esteemed wife would say that your life is lost in either case, were she here."
"Were she here, Your Grace?" Fidelius agreed. "May I proceed?"
Aquitaine stared down at Fidelius for a moment. Then he gestured toward the slave, who went scurrying, returning a moment later with parchment and pen. Aquitaine said,
"Be quick. My patience is rapidly running out." "Of course, Your Grace."
Fidelius accepted the paper and pen, dipped the quill into the inkpot, and swiftly made a few notes on the paper, careful to let no one see what he was writing. No one spoke, and the scritching of the quill seemed loud in the hall, along with the crackle of the fire pits and the impatient tapping of the High Lord's boot. Fidelius blew on the letters, then folded the paper in half and offered it to Aquitaine. Without looking away from the man, he said,
"Your Grace, I advise you to accelerate your plans. Contact your forces and move at once."
Calix stepped forward at once to Aquitaine's side.
"Your Grace, I must disagree in the strongest terms. Now is the time for caution. If we are discovered now, all will fall into ruin."
Aquitaine stared down at the letter, then lifted his eyes to Calix.
"And you believe that by doing so you will protect my interests?"
"And those of my lord," Calix said.
He lifted his chin, but the gesture meant little when the High Lord towered over him.
"Think of who is advising you, Your Grace."
"Ad hominem," noted Aquitaine, "is a notoriously weak logical argument, and is usually used to distract the focus of a discussion, to move it from an indefensible point, and to attack the opponent."
"Your Grace," Calix said, ducking his head, "please listen to reason. To act now would leave you at somewhat less than half your possible strength. Only a fool throws away an advantage like that."
Aquitaine lifted his eyebrows.
"Only a fool? My."
Calix swallowed. "Your Grace, I only meant what you meant is of little concern to me, Count Calix. What you said, however, is another matter entirely." "Your Grace, please, do not be rash. Your plans have been well laid for so long. Do not let them fall apart now."
Aquitaine glanced down at the paper and asked,
"And what do you propose, Your Excellency?"
Calix squared his shoulders.
"Put simply, Your Grace, stick to the original plan. Send the Windwolves to winter in Rhodes. Gather your legions when the weather breaks in the spring and use them then. Bide. Wait. In patience there is wisdom."
"Who dares wins,"
murmured Aquitaine back.
"I cannot help but wonder at how generous Rhodes seems to be, Calix. How he is willing to host the mercenaries, to have his name connected with them when the matter is settled. How thoroughly he has instructed you to protect my interests."
"The High Lord is always most interested in supporting his allies, Your Grace."
Aquitaine snorted. "Of course he is. We are all so generous with one another. And forgiving." "No, Calix. The cursor..."
"Former cursor, Your Grace,"
Fidelius put in.
"Former cursor, of course. The former cursor here has done a very good job of predicting what you would tell me."
Aquitaine consulted the paper he held.
"I wonder why that is."
He moved his eyes to Fidelius and arched his eyebrows. Fidelius watched Calix and said,
"Your Grace, I believe that Rhodes sent Calix here to you as a spy and eventually as an assassin."
"Why, you!"
Calix snarled. Fidelius overrode the other man, his voice iron.
"Calix wishes you to wait, so that there is time to remove you over the winter, Your Grace. The mercenaries will have several months to be tempted by bribes, meanwhile robbing you of their strength. Then, when the campaign begins, he will have key positions filled with people beholden to Rhodes. He can kill you in the confusion of battle, and therefore remove the threat you represent to him. Calix here was likely intended to be the assassin."
"I will not stand for this insult, Your Grace."
Aquitaine looked at Calix and said, "Yes, you will." To Fidelius he said, "And your advice? What would you have me do?" Fidelius shrugged.
"South winds rose tonight where there should have been none. Only the First Lord could call them at this time of year. At a guess, he called the Furies of the Southern Air to assist Amara or one of the other cursors north, either to the capital or to the valley itself."
"It could be coincidence," Aquitaine pointed out.
"I don't believe in coincidence, Your Grace," Fidelius said. "The First Lord is far from blind, and he has powers of fury crafting I can hardly begin to accurately assess. He has called the South Winds. He is hastening someone north, toward the Calderon Valley."
"Impossible," Aquitaine said. He rubbed at his jaw with the back of one hand. "But then Gaius was always an impossible man."
"Your Grace," Calix said, "surely you aren't seriously considering—"
Aquitaine lifted a hand.
"I am, Your Excellency."
"Your Grace!" Calix hissed. "This common-born dog has called me a murderer to my face." Aquitaine surveyed the scene for a moment, then quite deliberately took three or four steps away from them and turned his back, as though to study a tapestry hanging on one wall.
"Your Grace," Calix said, "I demand your justice in this matter."
"I rather tend to believe Fidelius, Your Excellency," he sighed. "Work it out among yourselves. I will deal appropriately with whoever is left."
Fidelius smiled. "Your Excellency, please allow me to add that you stink like a sheep, that your mouth froths with idiocy and poison, and that your guts are as yellow as a springtime daffodil."
He steepled his fingers, regarding Calix, and said, very soft and distinctly, "You are a coward." Calix's face flushed red, his eyes wild, and he moved, a sudden liquid blurring of his arms and hips. The sword at his side leapt free of its scabbard and toward Fidelius's throat. As fast as Calix was, Aldric moved faster. His arm alone whipped into motion, drawing the blade from his hip across the limp form of the woman on his lap. Steel met steel in a ringing chime only inches from Fidelius's face. Aldric slid to his feet, Odiana curling her legs beneath her as she lowered herself to the floor. The swordsman's face remained upon Calix's. Calix eyed Aldric and let out a sneer.
"Mercenary, do you think you can best an Alaran lord in battle?"
Aldric kept his blade lightly pressed to Calix's and shrugged.
"The only man who has ever matched me in battle was Araris Valerian himself."
Teeth shone white in Aldric's smile.
"And you aren't Araris."
There was a rasp, and then steel glittered and blurred in the dim light of the hall. Fidelius watched, hardly able to keep up with the speed of the attacks and counters. In the space of a slow breath, their swords met a dozen times, chiming out, casting sparks from one another's blades. The swordsmen parted briefly, then clashed together again. And the duel was over. Calix blinked, his eyes widening, and then lifted a hand to his throat as scarlet blood rushed from it. He tried to say something else but was unable to make any sound. Then the Rhodesian count fell to the ground and lay unmoving, but for a few faint tremors as his faltering heartbeat pumped the blood from his body. Odiana looked up at Aquitaine with a small, dreamy smile and asked,
"Ought I to save him, Your Grace?"
Aquitaine glanced back at Calix and shrugged.
"There seems to be little point in it, dear."
"Yes, Lord."
Odiana turned adoring eyes to Aldric and watched as the swordsman knelt down to wipe his blade clean of blood on Calix's cloak. The man clenched his fingers and let out a bubbling gasp. Aldric ignored him. Fidelius rose and went to Aquitaine's side.
"Was that to your satisfaction, Your Grace?"
Calyx was useful, Aquitaine said.
Then he glanced at Fidelius and asked,
How did you know?
Fidelius tilted his head.
That he was planning to kill you? Were you able to sense it in him?
Aquitaine nodded.
Once I knew to look for it.
He fell apart as you described the role Rhodes had assigned him.
We'll probably find a fury-bound dagger in his coat with my likeness and name etched into the steel.
Aldrich grunted, rolled the not-quite-dead Calyx onto his back and rummaged through his jacket. The telltale bulge Fidelius had seen earlier proved to be made by a small dagger with a compact hilt. Aldrich let out a hiss as he touched the knife and set it down hurriedly. Fidelius asked,
Fury-bound?
Aldrich nodded.
Nasty one. Strong. I think the knife should be destroyed.
Do it, Aquitaine said. Now, tonight. Odiana, go with him. I wish to speak to Fidelius alone.
The pair rested fist over their hearts and bowed their heads. Then Odiana slipped up to the swordsman's side and pressed to him until he circled her shoulders with one arm. The two left without looking back. On the floor, Calyx let out his death rattle, and his eyes glazed over, mouth hanging slightly open.
How did you know? Aquitaine repeated.
Fidelius glanced back at the dead Rhodesian count and shrugged.
To be honest, Your Grace, I didn't know. I guessed.
Aquitaine half smiled.
Based upon what?
Too many years in this line of work. And I've met Rhodes. He wouldn't step an inch from his way to help someone else, and he'd cut off his own nose just to spite his face.
Calyx was being too pleasant, Aquitaine murmured. Indeed. Perhaps I should have seen it sooner.
The important thing is that you acted promptly when you did see it, Your Grace.
Fidelius, Aquitaine said, I do not like you.
You have no reason to.
But I think I can respect you, after a fashion. And if it's to be a choice of who will put the knife in my back, I would rather it be you than Rhodes or one of his lackeys, I think.
Fidelius felt his mouth tug up at the corners.
Thank you. Make no mistake, man. Aquitaine turned to face him. I prefer to work with someone to forcing them to my will. But I can do it. And I can kill you if you become a problem. You know this, yes?
Fidelius nodded.
Good, Aquitaine said.
The High Lord covered his mouth with his hand and yawned.
It is late, and you are right about moving quickly before the Crown has a chance to act. Get a few hours' sleep. At dawn you leave for the Calderon Valley.
Fidelius bowed his head again.
Your Grace, I don't have any chambers here, as yet.
Aquitaine waved a hand toward the slave.
You, take him to your chambers for the night. Give him whatever he wants, and see to it that he is awake by dawn.
The slave bowed her head without speaking or looking up.
Have you studied much history, Fidelius?
Only a bit, Your Grace.
Fascinating. The course of a century of history can be set in a few short hours, a few precious days. Focal events, Fidelius, and those people who are a part of them become the ones to create tomorrow. I have sensed a distant stirring of forces from the direction of the valley. Gaius is already arousing the furies of the Calderon, perhaps. History is stirring, waiting to be nudged in one direction or the other.
I don't know about history, Your Grace. I just want to do my job.
Aquitaine nodded once.
Then do it. I will expect word from you.
And without another word, the High Lord strode from the hall. Fidelius watched him go and waited until the doors had closed behind him to turn to the slave girl. He offered her a hand, and she took it, her fingers warm and soft, her expression uncertain. Fidelius straightened his posture, bent, and placed a formally polite kiss to the back of the slave's fingers.
"Your Grace," he said. "High Lady Invidia, may I convey to you my heartfelt admiration."
The slave's expression flickered with shocked surprise. Then she threw back her head and laughed. Her features changed, subtle and significant, until the woman standing before him appeared to be several years older, her eyes holding a great deal more wisdom. Her eyes were grey, like ashes, and her hair had delicate feathers of frost all through it, though her features looked no older than a woman nearing her 30th year. All of the great houses had that kind of skill at watercrafting, or nearly any other form of fury crafting one could name.
"How did you guess?" she asked. "Not even my lord husband saw through the disguise."
"Your hands," Fidelius replied. "When you washed my feet, your fingers were warm. No slave in her right mind would have been anything less than anxious in that room. She would have had chilly fingers. And no one but you, I judged, would have had the temerity or skill to attempt such a thing with His Grace."
High Lady Aquitaine's eyes shone. "A most astute assessment," she said. "Yes, I had been using Calyx to find out more about what Rhodes was up to. And tonight was the night I thought I might get rid of him. I made sure that my husband was in a mood he would not enjoy being taken from, and waited for the Rhodesian fool to shove his foot down his own throat. Though I must say, you seemed to pick up on what was happening and ensure that it carried through without any hints from me, and not the least bit of fury crafting to assist you."
"Logic is a fury all its own."
She smiled, but then her expression grew serious, intent. "The operation in the valley. Will it succeed?"
"It might," Fidelius said. "If it does, it might accomplish what no amount of fighting or plotting could. He could win Alera without ever spilling Alaran blood."
"Not directly, in any case," said Lady Aquitaine. She sniffed. "Attis has few compunctions about blood. He is as subtle as a roaring volcano. But if his strength can be properly focused..."
Fidelius inclined his head.
"Just so."
The woman studied him for a moment, then took his hand. Her features shimmered and slid back into the mask of the slave girl she had worn before, the grey smoothing out of her hair, her eyes shading toward a dark, muddy brown rather than grey.
"In any case, I have my orders regarding you this night."
Fidelius hesitated.
"Your Grace."
Lady Aquitaine smiled. She touched her fingertips to his mouth and said,
"Don't make me press the point. Come with me. I will see to it that you rest deeply in what time you have."
She turned and started walking again.
"You have far to go. Come the dawn."
Chapter 8. When twilight fell, Tarvi knew that he was still in danger. He had not seen or heard either of his pursuers since he had slithered down an almost sheer rock cliff, using several frail saplings to slow what would have been a deadly plummet to a careening slide. It had been a perilous gamble, and Tarvi had counted on the sapling's frailty to betray the heavy Marat warrior, killing or at least slowing him. The plan had been only a partial success. The Marat looked once at the cliff and set off at a run to find a safe place to descend. It bought Tarvi enough of a lead to attempt to lose his pursuer, and he thought that he had begun to widen his lead. The Marat were not like the Alarans. They had no ability at fury crafting, though they were reported to possess an uncanny understanding of all the beasts of the field. It meant that the Marat had no vast advantage. Like Tarvi, he had only his wits and skill to guide him. The storm settled over the valley in a glowering veil as the light began to fade. Thunder growled forth, but there was no rise of wind, no fall of rain or sleet. The storm waited for the night to fall in full, while Tarvi kept a nervous eye on both the sky and the barrens around him. His legs ached and his chest burned, but he had avoided the Marat, and just before sundown he emerged from the barrens onto the causeway, several miles west of the lane to Bernard Holt.
He found a deep patch of shade beside a windfall and crouched there, panting, allowing his tired muscles a brief rest. Lightning flashed. He hadn't meant to move so far to the west. Instead of being nearly home again, Tarvi would have an hour-long run just to reach the lane down to the Steadholt. Thunder rumbled, this time so loud that it shook needles from the fallen pine beside him. There was a low, dull roar from the direction of Garados, and in a moment Tarvi heard it growing nearer. The rain had finally begun. It came in a wave of half-frozen sleet, and Tarvi barely had time to pull up his hood before a furious frozen wind howled down from the north, driving rain and ice alike before it. The storm devoured whatever meager scraps of daylight remained and drowned the valley in cold, miserable darkness, barring frequent flares of lightning skittering among the storm clouds. Though his cloak had been made to shed water, no fabric in Alera would have kept the rain and sleet of the fury storm out for long. His cloak grew cold and wet, clinging to him, and the bitter wind drove the chill straight through his garments and into his bones. Tarvi shivered hard. If he remained where he was, he would die from exposure to the storm in only hours, unless a bloodthirsty wind mane beat the cold to the punch. And though Brutus had surely reached the Steadholt with Bernard by now, he could not rely upon any of the Hold folk to rescue him. They knew better than to expose themselves to a fury storm. Tarvi peered at the windfall in the next lightning flash. There was a hollowed-out space underneath, thick with pine needles, and it looked dry. Tarvi started crawling inside, and the next lightning flash showed him an image from a nightmare. The windfall already had occupants. Half a dozen slives. The supple, dark-scaled lizards were nearly as long as Tarvi was tall, and the nearest lay within arm's reach. The lizard thrashed restlessly, stirring from its torpor. It opened its jaws and let out a syrupy hiss, showing rows of needle-pointed teeth. A thick yellow liquid coated the slive's front fangs. Tarvi had seen slive venom at work before. If the slive struck him, he would grow warm and sluggish until he sank slowly down to the ground. And then the slives would drag him, still alive, into their lair and eat him. Tarvi's first reaction was a terrified desire to spring away, but fast motion could trigger the surprised slive. Even if the slive missed, the filthy little scavengers would regard his flight as a sign that he was prey to be pursued and eaten. He could outrun them on open ground, but slives had a nasty tendency to remain on the trail of their prey, sometimes following for days, waiting for their target to sleep, before moving in for the kill. Fear and excitement made Tarvi tremble, but he forced himself to remain calm. He withdrew as slowly and smoothly as he could. He had just gotten out of the slive's striking range when the beast hissed again and bolted out of its shelter and toward the boy. Tarvi let out a panicked scream, his light baritone cracking into a child's higher pitch as he did. He threw himself back from the slive's deadly bite, got his feet underneath him, and started to run. Then, to his complete surprise, he heard someone call out in an answering shout, one nearly drowned out by the rising winds. Tarvi snarled in frustration. The memory of the Marat warrior and his terrible partner came back to him in a flood of terror. Had they caught up to him? The wind brought him another shout, the pitch too high to be the Marat. There was no mistaking the panic and fear in it.
"Please! Someone help!"
Tarvi bit his lip, looking down the causeway toward his home and safety, then facing the opposite way, toward the cry for help. He took a shaking breath and turned west, away from his home, and forced his tired legs into motion again, running along the pale stone of the causeway. The lightning flashed again, a shuddering flame that swept from cloud to cloud overhead, first green, then blue, then red, as though the furies of the skies had gone to battle against one another. Light bathed the rain-swept valley for nearly half a minute, while thunder shook the stones of the causeway and half deafened him. Shapes began to whirl down toward the ground through the tumult and rain, and raced and danced across the valley floor. the wind manes had followed the storm. Their luminous forms swirled and gusted effortlessly among the winds. Pale green clouds, nebulous and vaguely human in shape, with long-reaching arms and skeletal faces. The wind manes screamed their hatred and hunger, their cries rising even above the bellowing thunder. Tavi felt terror slow his legs, but he gritted his teeth and pressed on, until he could see that most of the wind manes in sight swirled around and around a central point, their pale, sharp-nailed hands reaching. In the center of the ghostly cyclone, there stood a young woman Tavi had never seen before. She was tall and slender, not unlike his own Aunt Isana, but there the resemblance to his aunt ended. The woman had skin of dark golden brown, like the traders from the southernmost cities of Alera. Her hair was straight and fine, whipped wildly about her by the wind, and was almost the same color as her skin, giving her something of the appearance of a golden statue. Her features were stark, striking, if not precisely lovely, with high cheekbones and a long, slender nose, softened by a generous mouth. Her face was set in a grimace of desperation and defiance. She wore a blood-stained cloth around her arm, and it looked as though she had torn her ragged, coarse skirts to make it. Her blouse was stained with grime and pressed against her by the rain, and a woven leather slave's collar circled her slender throat. As Tavi watched, one of the wind manes curled toward her in a graceful swoop. The girl cried out, throwing one hand toward the wind mane, and Tavi saw a pale blue stirring in the air, not as sharp or as well-defined as the wind manes themselves, but flashing there momentarily nonetheless, the spectral outline of a long-legged horse, lashing out with its forelegs at the woman's attacker. The wind mane screamed and fell back, and the woman's fury drove forward, though it moved more sluggishly than the manes, more slowly. Three more manes rushed the air fury's flanks, and the woman lifted her weight from a branch she had leaned upon, hobbling forward to swipe at the wind manes with desperate futility. Tavi reacted without thinking. He lurched into a tottering run, clawing at his pouch as he did. His balance wavered in the darkness between thunderbolts, but only a breath later the clouds lit up again. Blue, red, and green lightning warred for domination of the skies. One of the wind manes abruptly whipped around toward him and then surged at him through the frigid rain. Tavi clawed a smaller package from his pouch and tore it open. The wind mane howled in a spine-tingling scream, spreading its claws wide. Tavi grabbed at the crystals of salt within the packet and hurled a portion of them at the wind mane as it charged him. Half a dozen crystals tore through the fury like lead weights through cheesecloth. The wind mane let out an agonized scream, a note that sent terrified chills racing down Tavi's spine and into his belly. It curled in upon itself, green fire flaming up and over it as it began to tear wherever the crystals had hit. In seconds, the mane tore apart into smaller fragments that dispersed and vanished into the gale. Gone. The others of its kind scattered out into a wide circle, letting out screeches of rage. The slave looked back at Tavi, her eyes wide with desperate hope. She clutched at her stick and hobbled toward him, the ragged shape of her fury once more becoming unseen when the wind manes drew away. "Salt!" she shouted through the storm. "You have salt!" Tavi managed to draw a ragged breath and to shout back, "Not much!" His heart thudded and lurched in his chest, and he hurried to the slave's side, casting a look out and around him at the pale phosphorescence of the wind manes, circling the pair at a wary distance. "Bloody crows," he swore. "We can't stay out here. I've never seen so many in one storm." The slave squinted out at the darkness, shivering, but her voice came to him clearly. "Can your furies shelter us at all?" Tavi felt a sickly little rush in his belly. Of course they couldn't, as he didn't have any. "No." "Then we've got to get to shelter. That mountain. There could be a cave—" "No," Tavi blurted. "Not that mountain.
It doesn't like trespassers. The girl pressed her hand against her head, panting. She looked exhausted.